Okay, so every year before Pesach, I always like to get ready, you know, by looking at the Haggadah, pulling out some points from the Haggadah to help us appreciate the Seder, appreciate what we're supposed to actually accomplish on Pesach. I'll just give a brief introduction to, I think, our goals at the Seder, and then I want to choose one selection from the Haggadah to look at today. I understand that the Seder has two main goals. I mean, the Seder is considered one of the most special nights of the Jewish year, if not the most special night of the Jewish year in many ways. It's a very lofty, elevated night, full of opportunities for growth and connection to God. And the, I think the two, everyone has to go into Seder with a goal, because we want to be able to use the Seder in order to grow as Jews. We could just read the text and do what we're supposed to do, eat the matzah, and have a Seder. But we want to use the Seder as an opportunity for spiritual growth, not just as a time to read the text once again and move on. So what should be our goals in entering the Seder? So I think the first goal is the way that the Haggadah puts it. It says, let's read the, you don't have to go to this one, but I'll just read you the one line. It says that in every generation, each human must hold the awareness. Actually, I don't like the translation. I'll translate it on my own. In every generation, every person must see themselves as if they left Egypt. As it says, you should tell it to your son on that day, saying, because of this, God took me out of Egypt. So, the Haggadah continues. Not only did God take our ancestors out of Egypt, but also ourselves were redeemed along with our ancestors. And there is a goal in the Seder that we're supposed to view ourselves as if we actually went through the experience of bondage, and we went through the experience of freedom. Now, what does that mean exactly? It's very hard to vision ourselves as slaves building pyramids in ancient Egypt. I mean, thank God we're living in America. We're not slaves. We've never set foot, you know, into Egypt, possibly. I don't know who's been to Egypt, but it's very hard to envision ourselves as if we've been slaves in Egypt. And also even to envision ourselves as being involved in the freedom, to actually witness 10 plagues before our eyes, the splitting of the sea, it's something which we can't really fully sink ourselves into. It's a very difficult thing to envision. However, what's the Haggadah trying to tell us? Haggadah's trying to tell us that there's a goal of the Seder night, that one should develop such a sense of gratitude towards God, what we call a karas atil, to show our acknowledgement and thanks towards God for bringing us to where we are this very day. That's really our goal. I mean, the more that we can feel ourselves as if we've been enslaved, and we've gone through suffering, we've come out at the end as free people, you know, shown God's love and God's protection. So that should bring us to a great sense of a karas atil, of gratitude and thanks towards God. So the first goal of the Seder would be to try to tap into the events of the Seder and feel like, what would it have been like to be a slave? Picture ourselves, or our loved ones, or our friends in slavery. Picture what it would be like to be tormented by Egyptian taskmasters. That's one level of it. But beyond that, it's also, the word in Hebrew for Egypt is Mitzrayim, which comes from the root word Mitzar, which is distress, difficulties. And every single person has their own difficulties they've been through. We've all had our own distress in life, our own challenges, our own difficulties. And all of us, in one way or the other, have come out on the other end from these difficulties, come to freedom. And the goal is that God not only redeems us from Egypt in the physical sense, in the historical sense, but also God redeems us from our own private Egypts that we've been in. We've all been in our own types of servitude and slavery, everyone on their own level, everyone in their own way. Whether it be physical, emotional, financial, everyone has their own personal Egypts that they've been enslaved to. And everybody, in one way or the other, life has become free from different things in their lives. Everybody's overcome challenges. Everybody's overcome hurdles in life. And to attribute that all of those accomplishments have been due to God's help and God's grace, that's something which should bring us to a great sense of recognition and thanks and gratitude towards God. So when you see yourselves that you left Egypt, you're trying to tap into the feelings of a slave being freed, how much gratitude we have towards his Savior. And if we can come to those deep feelings of gratitude towards God, that would be a tremendous accomplishment for Pesach night. That's number one. I think that the deeper message of seeing ourselves as if we left Egypt, it's not just a mental exercise in trying to feel yourself as a slave, but it's how much gratitude can you develop over the night towards God. I think the second goal of the Seder night is that the Seder night is known to be a night where we're supposed to come to a deeper understanding, appreciation of all the foundations and fundamentals of Judaism. Meaning that, I think we mentioned last week, that the reason that God, this is the Kamna of Nachmanides, the reason, Ramban, Nachmanides, the reason that God went through such a tremendous display of his power in Egypt. I mean, God could have just picked this up and popped this down in Israel. He didn't have to go through 10 plagues and splitting of the sea and all these miracles. Why do that? He wanted to reveal himself for the world, for history. The Exodus from Egypt is the point in history where God said, here I am. This is who I am. This is what I can do. I care about the world. I run the world. I can overturn nature. I have my special people. I reward the righteous. I punish the wicked. Every single foundation of our belief is found somewhere in the story of the Exodus. Every single one. And that was revealed once in history in a global sense. At that point, the whole world recognized what was happening in Egypt. And God revealed himself to the whole world at that point. And that all came to a culmination to some degree on the night of the Seder when we left Egypt. And that's the night where we're supposed to then tell every generation of Jews throughout history all the miracles which we experienced in Egypt, all about what God displayed towards us. And that's supposed to strengthen our connection to God, our connection to our faith, and help us understand what are the foundations of Judaism. What does Judaism stand upon? What are the pillars of the Torah? And that was all revealed in Egypt. So Seder night tonight, specially set aside during the year to sit around a table and discuss what are the fundamentals of Judaism? What are the foundations we find within the Seder, within the Haggadah? There are some extra ones here. What are the fundamentals of Judaism found in the Haggadah and the story of the Exodus, which impact us every single day of our lives? Whether it be the fact that God rewards and punishes, whether it be the fact that God can overturn nature, whether it be the fact that God has a special people, whether it be the fact that God, there is divine providence in this world, and God guides events. I mean, there's so many things you can find in the story. But this is the time where we have, there's a night set aside in the year to sit around and discuss these with those who are with us at our Seder. And it's a time where we can truly absorb this, a connection, and create a connection to the fundamentals of what it means to be a Jew. So those, I think, are the two goals of Seder night. And we should all strive in one way or the other to accomplish these goals. Everyone on their own level. You don't have to focus on every single event and every single miracle that happened in Egypt. You can focus on one idea. You can focus on one fundamental. The truth is, you know, my own personal Seder, we try to focus every year just on one main point, whether it be the point that, you know, God loves Jewish people, or the point that, you know, things that look negative really are for the best, or the point that, you know, God runs the world. Every year we try to choose one topic and try to bring that through the story. Because there are so many fundamental topics of Judaism which are found in this story. So it's overwhelming to try to get everything. But if you can choose just one simple idea which you find to be meaningful and inspiring, or an idea that you want to explore more. And Seder night is a great night to explore these fundamental ideas of Judaism. This is really a time set aside for us to grow in our emunah, grow in our faith in God, and grow in our connection to God. So that's our two goals of Seder, to develop a great sense of gratitude towards God and appreciation, and also to develop a deeper understanding of the fundamentals of Judaism. This, I think, are the two major goals of the Seder night. What I want to focus on today is probably one of the most famous parts of the Seder, which is Dayenu. It's on page 20 if you have the Maxwell House Haggadah. I think there's one intruder out there, not Maxwell House one, so that one you can find it in there. But it's on page 20 of the Maxwell House Haggadah. I think Dayenu has become so famous just based on the catchy tune. But Dayenu happens to be a great part of the Haggadah to develop this sense of gratitude towards God. In terms of that first goal we mentioned, that we're trying to develop and reach a great sense of gratitude towards God, Dayenu is really an expression of this. And just to take it simply, Dayenu is the part of the Haggadah that lists every single step in which God performed a new miracle to save the Jews. And we'll go through the steps as we go through the class today. But when you're trying to give somebody thanks, someone does something for you. So you can say thank you, which is a very basic sense of gratitude. But when you go to the person and specify exactly what they did, it's much more meaningful. So you say, you know, I was having very difficult times. You came over to me, and you were so kind, and you said kind words, you offered your help, but then you drove me somewhere I needed to get to, and you gave me a loan, and you helped out my family. And then if you go through every specific, that's so much more meaningful than just saying thank you so much for all you did. So in Dayenu, we actually specify each and every kindness God did for us. And this is really a pinnacle sort of in the sense of expressing gratitude. This is kind of a climax of the Seder in terms of the gratitude that we show before we get to the Hallel, which is the prayer of gratitude. So that's the meaning of Dayenu. But it's the idea of specifying each and every kindness God did for us. There's a verse in the prophets. It says, I'm going to rain down upon you bracha, blessing, ad bli dai, until, the word bli dai is very hard to translate, until you're without dai. Dai means enough, right? The Yenu has been enough. It was sufficient. So it says until you are without enough. So the rabbis say, what does it mean to be without enough? The rabbis say that God gives us so many blessings that our lips will be worn out from saying, that's enough, so many blessings, there's so much gratitude to give. And Dayenu is really expressing that. We keep saying, Dai, enough, enough, God, there's so many kindness you've done for us. We keep on going, Dayenu, we keep on going forever. I mean, it's something we say every single Shabbos morning in the davening, in the Nishmas prayer, we say, Enoch Mas Bikim Odos Lecha. We do not have the sufficient ability to give enough thanks to you, God. We could spend our entire lifetime thanking God for all he's done for us, and we still haven't sufficed. So Dayenu is an expression that, you know, that there's so much that God does for us, and as much as we thank God, there's always more to thank him for. But Dayenu at least gives us some sort of framework of, it's for 15 steps we'll discuss here in Dayenu, to thank God at least each of these particular kindnesses did for us throughout our time in Egypt. The Malbim, one of the famous commentators on the Tanakh and also in the Haggadah, he says that the idea of the word Dayenu, I mean Dayenu means it would have been enough, it would be sufficient. And he says, what would be sufficient? Each and every one of these kindnesses would be sufficient to have to thank God. That's what it means. Every single one of these would have been sufficient to cause us, to obligate us, to show a tremendous amount of gratitude towards God. Because each one of these miracles was an incredible thing. But really, since there are so many things, our obligation is beyond limit. You know, we keep on thanking God for so many things he's done for us. And the Malbim writes that this section of the Haggadah began with Dayenu. And it really is all a lead up towards Hallel. Hallel is a section of the Gada, which Hallel is the official prayer, which the rabbis obligate us to say in times of for showing praise. And we begin by listing all the kindnesses of Dayenu. We then discuss the significance of the object of the Seder, the Pesach, Matzah, and the Maror, and the bitter herbs. And then we say, and therefore, on page 24 it says, and therefore, we're bound to thank and praise and speak well of and glorify and admire and honor and bless and exalt and revere, etc., God, and then we get into Hallel. So this is all just a lead up to saying the Hallel prayer, because it's showing us how much gratitude we truly owe towards God. So this should kind of get us in the mood to want to, you know, sing out the Hallel. That's what we should be in the mood for. And essentially, the Seder is supposed to be not just a recitation, but an experience. We're supposed to, you know, there's a reason that the rabbis gave us the words of the Haggadah, and we have the God requires us to eat the matzah and the bitter herbs, and we have in our Seder all these different activities and things to do, because it's supposed to be a full body experience. It's mind, body, and soul. It's not just a recitation and a ritual. We're supposed to be involved and really feel the events that are happening. So therefore, when you get to Hallel, it's not just that, okay, the Haggadah tells you, say Hallel here. You should be feeling so much gratitude that you want to burst out in Hallel, because you've just experienced so many of God's kindnesses throughout relating the story of the Haggadah, that all you want to do now is sing praises to God. And that's the goal of the Haggadah, is that the Hallel shouldn't just be that I'm reading what it says in the text, but Hallel should be as the heartfelt expression of gratitude towards God for all he's done for us. The Dayenu has 15 steps. You count, there are 15 steps in Dayenu. The number 15 is very significant. The Seder itself has 15 steps. The Kadesh, Rechatz, Karpas, Yechatz, the 15 signs of the Seder, there are 15 of them. Dayenu has 15 steps in it. There were 15 steps that led up to the courtyard of the Beis Hamikdash. In the temple in Jerusalem, there are 15 steps leading up into the courtyard. We know that in Tehillim, in the Psalms, there are 15 Psalms called Shir Hamalos, the songs of literally steps. And those correspond to 15 steps going into the temple, and they all correspond to 15 steps of the Seder. All these 15s go together. So what's the idea of 15? I mean, I'm sure if we thought about it, we could have added in more Dayenus too. I mean, these 15 things of Dayenu were all very significant miracles, but I'm sure if we read the story of the Exodus, we could specify each plague. We could specify a lot more things. But the author of the Haggadah chose these 15. Why is 15 significant? Yud-Heh. What? Yud-Heh. So, well, Yud-Heh is one of the names of God, which is Phil's bringing out, which is also very significant. The Yud-Heh is the gematria, the miracle value of 15. And that does really, certainly relates to this. But I guess on a more basic level, the idea of 15 is that 15 is the Jewish people compared to the moon. And for the moon to go from a new moon to a full moon, it's 15 days of the month. On the 15th day of the month, of the Jewish month, the moon is full. It's 15 days. Why are we compared to the moon? So many reasons are given, but simply, the moon is a reflection of the sun. And we as Jews are supposed to be a reflection of God, which is to live our lives in a way which we reflect God's light. And people look at a Jew and they say, I can see God through that Jew. Just like when you look at the moon, you can see sunlight through the moon. That's how the moon works. It's a reflection. So the moon is something which is always reflecting the sunlight. You know, God is compared to the sun in Psalms. And the Jews are always reflecting God's light. That's the comparison. But it takes 15 days for the moon to reach its fullness. It's 15 days with a full moon. Pesach is on the 15th of the month. It's the full moon. The holiday of Pesach is on the 15th of Nisan, which is a full moon. But the idea is that the 15 steps of the Seder are supposed to bring us to a certain completion, a certain perfection. I mean, the idea of 15, and the symbolism of 15 is just like the moon in 15 days is complete. So 15 steps create a completion, create a perfection. So just like when you're walking up to the temple, what's happening? You're leaving the mundane world, entering into a world of sanctity. So you have 15 steps to get there. When you get to that world of sanctity, you reach a certain perfection in life, a spiritual perfection by being in the temple. When you have your Seder, the Seder is supposed to be, like I said, it's not just a recitation, it's not just a ritual, but it's supposed to be an experience. And the Seder is 15 steps to help to bring us to higher levels of spirituality, a deep relationship with God. It's 15 steps to bring us somewhere. We're going somewhere at the Seder. We're trying to reach a certain perfection at the end of the Seder. The idea of leaving Egypt. When we left Egypt, the Jews in Egypt were at a very low level, spiritually, physically, emotionally, financially, at all levels. The Jews were obviously downtrodden slaves, beaten by the Egyptian taskmasters. Spiritually, the Jews were idolaters at that point. Maimonides writes that the Jews had almost lost everything that Abraham had taught them. They had Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob teaching them about God and about the Torah, and in their time in slavery, they almost lost it all. So they were holding on by a thread, basically. And they were on a very low level. But God took them from being these lowly slaves all the way up to the high levels of what a Jew is supposed to be, culminating in what it says in Dayenu, the building of the temple, which was the high point of Jewish history until now. And that's the 15 steps. It's the 15 steps for going from the new moon, which is merely a tiny sliver of light, to a complete full moon, which gives light to the entire to the entire night. That's the idea. So it's also interesting, as a side point, the temple was built by Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. And again, the years of King Solomon are considered kind of the high point of history, because after that, things started going downhill. We entered into exile and destruction after that. But there was 15 generations just passed from the times of Abraham until the times of King Solomon. So we've gone from Abraham's time, which was when the Jews just first started appearing on the scene. Abraham was really the first one to teach monotheism and become the first Jew. And for 15 generations, we were growing and growing until we got to that full moonlight of the times of King Solomon. So that number 15 is significant in bringing things to their perfection and completion. So that's the idea of the 15. So Dayenu's 15 steps bring us from being downtrodden slaves in Egypt to being in the land of Israel, building the temple. That's 50 steps of Dayenu. That's how it culminates. So I want to take each step here and just understand what are we describing in each step? What's the significance of these steps? So if you go to page 21, again, I don't like translations, especially the Maximus one. I find it to be extremely difficult at times. I even think that they've had several versions of the Maximus Agadas, I think. I've never seen them over the years. But this one, I think, has become a little more politically correct, but a little less loyal to the actual text of the Haggadah, so I don't know. But we'll read and translate as needed. So the first step of Dayenu says, if God has brought us out of Egypt and had not inflicted judgment upon the Egyptians, it would have been sufficient. So obviously, the Seder begins with God taking us out of Egypt. So we have to give thanks to God for freeing us. But freedom may have just been freedom from physical bondage, the physical freedom. So it's like, okay, you used to be slaves, and now you're free. And God could have left us at that. He said, okay, thank you very much, nice knowing you, and I'm heading back up to the heavens. You know, that's what God could have said. But so, and that would have been Dayenu. That would have been sufficient. At that point, we'd have to show a lot of gratitude towards God because God freed us from slavery. But God went far beyond that. What happened next? It says that God inflicted justice upon the Egyptians. Again, he didn't just release our bonds, stick us in Israel or in the desert, and say, okay, see you later. But God then punished our oppressors. Now, what's the idea of God punishing our oppressors? So many commentators point out that Dayenu is not just to show about how to give thanks to God, but it's showing how special the Jewish people are. And everything that Dayenu is supposed to show how special we are. So when God punishes our oppressors, it shows that God takes on the plight of the Jewish people. That the people out there who are going to oppress us, persecute us, but God is always there to protect us. He's our Savior, He's our protector. It also shows there's accountability in this world, that you can't get off the hook. You know, somebody who does evil, eventually what goes around comes around, that person will get their justice as well. So we have to thank God as well for inflicting justice upon our oppressors, which means that God is the one who takes up our plight and saves us from difficulties. And then it says next, if God had executed judgment so he says if he inflicted justice upon them, but not execute judgment against their gods, it would have been sufficient. But then God, not only did he inflict justice upon the Egyptians, but he also judged their gods. I mean, what happened? All the idols of Egypt were also destroyed, or somehow shown to be false. I mean, the Egyptians' primary gods were the Nile, which was afflicted with a plague of blood. The Egyptians worshipped Pharaoh, obviously was brought to his knees groveling in this story. The Egyptians worshipped sheep, which we slaughtered to be our Paschal lamb, our Pesach sacrifice. The Egyptians had other idols which were crushed throughout the plagues. And God inflicted justice upon the Egyptian idols and gods as well. Now what's the significance of that? The idea is to show that God says, I'm on top of it all. That I am the one who's in control. And even though we do believe as Jews that there are certain, we'll call them, systems that God puts into place. Meaning, different writings of the Talmud and other scholars discuss how God does the wonderful at times through, I don't want to say natural means, but he might put certain processes into place which run kind of on their own. But God could overcome all those processes. And what I mean by that, just to be, this would be a longer discussion. But there is an idea, even the whole idea of astrology and the zodiac, it comes from Jewish sources. We do believe that certain months of the year have certain impressions upon people. We do believe that there is some idea, certain stars affecting the world. And again, this could be a longer discussion, what that means and how it works. But we understand that God puts certain systems into place which do impact the world in different ways. But those systems don't function on their own. They function under God's control. And any second God wants, he can come and he can overturn that system. So when God took the Jews out of Egypt, the rabbis describe it that God, they call it Shodin Marachos. God was able just to destroy all the systems that were in place. He has the override button, we'll call it. And every single system that was out there, God overrides them all. So when God comes and destroys all the Egyptian idols, even if there are some things in Egypt which may have had some sort of influence on how the Egyptians functioned, it was only a tool in God's hands. It wasn't anything which functioned on its own right. God shows the world that he is in control of it all. And we as Jews perceive that the one who's in control of everything out there, even though the things that seem in our eyes as powerful, God's on top of all of that. So this is the idea that God, when he executed judgment upon the gods of the Egyptians, he was showing that no matter what they have, I control it all. I'm on top of it all. I can destroy it all. I can override it all. And we can even view it just, nature in a certain sense is a god to us. Because nature is powerful. You can't override the laws of physics, the laws of nature. You can't defy gravity. But God can. And God says that anything you think in this world that does have power other than me, I can defy that too, because I'm the one who created those powers. I can destroy those powers, override them at my will. Another commentator, his name is Rav Yitzchak Isaac Chaver, he wrote a Haggadah called Yam Mitzrayim, The Hand of Egypt. So he writes that at this point, not only did God overturn the Egyptian idols, but God is showing that he places the control of the world in the hands of the Jews. Meaning that even though there are systems in place, but when a Jew does the right things, God will then overturn those systems. When Jews do the wrong things, then God may also overturn systems to do other things. But the systems are not set in stone. The way this world runs is not something which is standard, but yet, based on the actions of the Jews, God will act based on our own actions. So we, in a sense, at this point, we receive control. We have the keys to the entire world. That if we do the right things, God will run the world a certain way. If we do the wrong things, God runs the world a certain way. And we have to be sure that we understand the power that's in our hands as God's chosen people. So this is the idea of executing judgment upon their gods. So it says next that if he only judged their gods, but didn't slaughter their firstborns, dayenu. And then, but if God slaughtered their firstborns and didn't turn their wealth over to us, also dayenu. So there's this emphasis on slaughtering the firstborns. Now the question one would ask is that we already discussed it inflicting justice upon the Egyptians as a separate dayenu. Right? We said in the second line of dayenu, the second stanza, that God punished the Egyptians. So we would think that slaughtering the firstborns is part of the punishment. But yet we specify it in dayenu. What's the significance of slaughtering the firstborns beyond just typical judgment of the Egyptians? So on this, the same Haggadah I quoted before, this Yad Mitzrayim, him in Egypt. He writes that it's a direct parallel to one of the other verses in the Torah, which I'll read. In the very beginning of the entire episode of the Exodus, when Moshe first comes to speaks with God, and God tells him to go to Pharaoh. So he says, you should go tell Pharaoh. Let's read it to you. He says, you should tell Pharaoh, Ko amar Hashem, thus says God, Bini b'chor Yisrael, the Jews are my firstborn son. And I'm telling you, send out my son, God tells Pharaoh, and let him serve me. And if you refuse, I'm going to kill your firstborn son. So God calls the Jews his firstborn son, and God says, if you don't send out my firstborn son, I'm going to take away your firstborn son. That's what God tells him. The most significance of being the firstborn son is the idea that we are God's chosen people. And killing off the firstborn of Egypt was emphasizing the idea that we are God's firstborn children. And God, we're his firstborn, seemingly that all people can be considered God's children. Everybody is dear to God. Even non-Jews are dear to God in many ways. But we're God's special child. We're his firstborn son, as we're calling it. We're the ones who are chosen by God for a special mission. We're unique. And therefore, God threatens and says, if you're going to oppress my firstborn, unique child, I'm going to take away your firstborn child. So the killing of the firstborn was an emphasis on the fact that we are God's special children. And that's why this was a separate dayenu, and an additional reason to bring out how unique and special the Jewish people are, and another reason to give thanks to God. It then says, well, if God had slaughtered the firstborns and not turned over their wealth to us, it would have been sufficient. So when the Jews left Egypt, the Torah writes that we essentially took the money from the Egyptians as well. The Gemara tells us that we really cleared out the land of all their wealth, which is an interesting discussion on its own, right? Why was that so significant? Which we'll discuss a little bit here. When we left Egypt, we didn't only leave, we took the wealth of Egypt with us. So why is that so significant? I mean, it's nice to leave lots of money. Desert money doesn't do much for you, you know? Actually, the rabbis say that the money ended up being a curse because they had so much gold they could build a golden calf. You know, so it didn't even turn out to be necessarily a positive thing. But what's the idea of taking their money? Why is that such a significant thing for us? So again, the same Haggadah we were quoting before, the Yad Mitzrayim, he writes 2 points. He says, number one, where did all this money come from? Why was Egypt so wealthy? So we know in the Torah what happened. There was 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. And Joseph's put in charge of all of Mitzrayim, all of Egypt, and the entire world was coming to Egypt for food. And when they came to Egypt for food, because Egypt had all these vast storehouses of food, so Joseph charged them for the food. And Egypt became the world superpower based on Joseph's wisdom and Joseph's planning. And he was the one who allowed Egypt to accumulate so much wealth. And this is the Gemara points this out as well. So what happened? This was a few hundred years in the process. But a few hundred years later, when the Jews left Egypt, so all that money that Joseph himself gathered to Egypt, the Jews took with them. And it's showing that all the money that was accumulated was really for the sake of the Jews. At one point you could have thought, wow, God for some reason has propped up Egypt as the world superpower. And now God's allowed Egypt to oppress the Jews and enslave them. But really, you look back in retrospect, and it turns out that no, that was all Joseph's doing. And it was all God setting it up that the Jews should leave as wealthy people when they left Egypt. And it shows us that God plans world events for our sake. Like we discussed at length concerning Purim, that world events, world history is orchestrated by God to lead to certain goals. And we see in Egypt that even though it's very difficult to see the connection between Joseph accumulating all that wealth and just leaving all the wealth, it was 200 years later, plus. But yet, we see that all these events were orchestrated only so that we could leave with so much wealth. He says, furthermore, the significance of leaving with the wealth is there's even a deeper point. He said that we served as slaves in Egypt for a very long time, and slaves don't get paid. But when we left Egypt with all that wealth, that was essentially our wages for all those years of slavery. So it turns out that, you know, retroactively, we weren't actually even enslaved, because if you get paid, you're not really a slave anymore. So we left Egypt with all the money of the Egyptians, because we had worked for them for so long, they owed us all their money. We did so much work for them. And at that point, you look back and you see the Jews were never really enslaved in the first place, because slaves don't get paid. They left with a great salary. That's what we see. Now, what's so significant is because God was expressing to us that you are my people, and you are not slaves. Even though you thought you were slaves, you're never really slaves in the first place, because you got paid for it. Because nobody can enslave my people. Because you're my special people, and you cannot be enslaved by human beings. So this is another way that God is emphasizing and highlighting the fact that the Jews are a special people, that the Jews have a distinct role in the world, and that even those who tried to enslave us at the end weren't successful, because we still left all their money. That's what this commentary describes. But it's like a retro, you know, we're being paid retroactively for 100 years of labor. That's what it was. And therefore, we never actually were slave laborers. We were just normal employees, which is, you know, there's nothing wrong being an employee. It's beneath our dignity to become slaves, but it's distinguished to be a good worker. So it turns out that we were good workers at the end, and we got a salary. So that's the idea of receiving their money. Next it says, well, if we had received their money, and God did not divide the sea for us, it would have been sufficient. So this one's actually harder to swallow, because if we went to the sea, and God didn't split it, we'd all be dead. Right? I mean, we were surrounded on one side by the Egyptian army, on the other side by the sea. The rabbis even described there were like packs of wild animals on the other side, you know, in the other direction. So at this point, if God didn't split the sea, we would have been gone. So it wouldn't have been sufficient to have left Egypt with their money and not cross the sea. It wouldn't have been sufficient. So what is the God telling us here? So simply, the idea of not splitting the sea would have been that God could have saved us in more simple ways. I mean, God didn't have to take us and perform this tremendous miracle of splitting a sea, that, you know, which is looked at as kind of the greatest miracle of history in a certain sense. God could have taken us in a different direction. God could have told us to, you know, walk around the side and, you know, go that way. You know, go. I don't know, they probably went northeast, they go south or something. I mean, God didn't have to take us through the sea. But God took us through the sea for a reason. And the idea of taking us through the sea was that, as we said before, God wanted to create a spectacle of miracles. Even more than that, another commentator, the Maisa Nisim, his name is Haggadah, the miracle worker is the Haggadah. But the idea is that when God split the sea, the rabbis tell us that not only did the sea split, but every single body of water in the world split at that time. So it wasn't just a revelation of God's power to the Jews standing at the Red Sea. It was a revelation of God's power to the entire world. If you were sitting there having a glass of water, and the Jews were crossing the sea, your glass of water split. If you're taking a bath, your bathtub split. You know, if you were taking a dip in the Atlantic split. I mean, every single body of water in the world, including drinking water, it all split at that point. So splitting the sea was a revelation to the entire world of God's power. And God was showing them, look, I'm turning the entire world at this point topsy-turvy on behalf of this people over here, this Jewish people, because they are my special people. And therefore, the whole world is privy to God's power and God's miraculous providence over the Jewish people. And that was all done in the splitting of the sea. Then the Haggadah continues. If God had split the sea, but not had us pass through on dry land, it would have been sufficient. The Torah says not only did the sea split, but the lands, the ocean bed dried up. And they walked over on firm land. And we can imagine that had the sea just split, it would have been a sandy, mushy, dirty ocean floor. But God had it dried out. The rabbis talk about other miracles which occurred at that time. It was a very comfortable experience. The land was dry, it was smooth, it was clean. It was a very comfortable experience. So it's nice to have extra comfort. But what's the significance of this? Like, why is that such an important miracle? I mean, it's like a bonus. Like, not only did I split the sea for you, I mean, we would have been just fine had I not done that. We would have said, thank you for splitting the sea, you know, we're going to run away from the Egyptians, and, you know, we wouldn't be bothered by the sandy, wet ground. Why was it important that God made the grounds dry? So at the point, I think the point here is that there's a concept which is discussed by Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, the Mir Yeshiva in Jerusalem. He writes that there's times where you find God performing miracles that aren't quite necessary. Like, for instance, he says, when Joseph was sold to go to Egypt by his brothers. So he goes on to the caravan. And the Torah tells us the caravan was carrying all these like beautiful perfumes and nice smelling spices. So he says, well, I mean, that's wonderful. Usually these Arab caravans carry things which had a foul smell. They carried some sort of like fuels and gases, I don't know, things. He says, you know, foul smelling items. But yet this caravan Joseph was sold to was carrying nice perfumes. So why? So the rabbis tell us, we don't want this righteous Joseph to have to smell things which are not pleasant smelling. Now, from Joseph's angle, like, what was the big... He was just almost killed by his brothers. He's being sold into slavery the rest of his life, as far as he can tell. He's being totally detached from his family, from his parents, from everything else. Like, did he really care that it was a nice-smelling caravan versus a bad-smelling caravan at the time? But Rabbi Shlomitz writes that sometimes God shows you that even though things are difficult, I'm still here with you. And I care about the individual, I care about you. And this was weird. If Joseph understood this miracle, which assumingly he did, he understood that God's giving him a sign that I still love you, I'm still with you, and I'm giving you like a kiss. You know, God's giving you, I'm a kiss, I'm still with you, don't worry. It can be compared to buying someone a bouquet of flowers. Sure, I care about you. The flowers aren't really significant. I mean, you put them, they look at them for a while and they die. But it's an expression of care, that I care about you, I'm with you, I'm thinking about you. In Rabbi Shlomitz, he brings several examples of miracles which God performs, which were not necessary miracles. Like, we understand why God had to save us from Egypt. If not for that, we would have been slaves or dead. We understand why when the Greeks attacked us in the Hanukkah story, we had to win this war at all odds, or else there'd be no more Jews. But we don't understand why God has to perform miracles. This seems to be just like extra bonus points, but nothing that is a necessity. But the answer is that God sometimes wants to point to the individual and show that I care about you, I love you, and even though all these things are going on around, I'm still with you. So here too, they were crossing the sea. And we just mentioned, well, God didn't only split the sea, he split every body of water in the world. And God had an agenda here to show the world that, look, I have power over everything. So we may have been lost in that mix, and God, and we as Jews might think, okay, you know, we're running across the sea, and God's performing miracles to show his power to the whole world. Does God really care about us individually, or is God just trying to display his power? And God says, well, look, I dried out the ocean floor for you, because I wanted to give you a comfortable experience. Because I'm not just trying to show the world my might, I'm also showing you my love. And when I dried the ocean floor, that was showing you that I care about your experience as you cross over the water. I'm not just trying to show the world how powerful I am. So this is like an extra kiss from God, showing us that he cares about us as a people, as individuals, not only was he out to display his own power and honor to the world. The Chasam Sofer writes an additional point about the dry land. He says the dry land proved that this wasn't just a natural occurrence. And even to this very day, often every once in a while you find a different like study or report, how they can show the splitting of the Red Sea was actually natural. You know, if the winds blow at the right angle, it's the right time of day, and the elevation of the moon is in the right spot, and it's the right season, and the temperature's right, then you could get water to split. I mean, there are these crazy studies, I'm sure you can Google it, and you can see a lot of studies like that. And the Torah even says that the wind was blowing. God had the wind blow. God brought in a wind to blow when he split the sea. So people would tend to think, well, maybe this wasn't God's doing. It happened to be a fluke of nature. You know, the right place at the right time. The Jews are about to be killed by the Egyptians, and suddenly, poof, this once-in-a-history phenomena happens naturally, and the sea splits. The Egyptians had the bad luck that it fell right back on their heads. Because the temperature changed by 2 degrees, and suddenly the waters collapsed. So some might think that. And it sounds crazy. You know, people do think that, because you can read studies. I've seen studies like this before. But the Chasam Sofer writes, no scientific study could prove how the land dried out in a matter of seconds. You know, so even if you were to think, well, there's some natural way to split a sea through winds and the climate and everything else, but the fact that the land was dry, that's the sign this was from God and not just some natural fluke of nature. Again, what bothers me with these studies is that even if we can explain naturally how the sea could split, obviously, it was orchestrated at the exact right time. And who's doing that? That's also, if you're trying to have the studies to avoid mentioning that there's a God in the world, well, I mean, how likely is it that one time in history phenomenon, the sea splitting, happens right as the Jews were standing at the bank? You know, like, who's the one who put all the winds in place, got the temperature to the right temperature to let the sea split? That's also God. So I don't know what they accomplished in these studies. But either way, the Chasam Sofer writes, the dry land itself proved that it wasn't natural, it was God. It then says that had God split the sea and passed over a dry land, but not drowned our oppressors in it, that also would have been dayino, it would have been sufficient. So that God drowned our oppressors, the Egyptians were drowned in the sea. Essentially, the drowning of the Egyptians in the sea, that was the finality upon the event. We're showing, look, I freed you, I punished them, you took their money, I showed you my love, and look, they're all gone and you're still here. And that was a symbol for the Jews that we are God's special people and nobody's going to get away with trying to oppress us. And throughout history, we think they do get away with it sometimes. You know, we've experienced so much over the course of history where people seem to oppress the Jews and escape. But God sends us signs that says nobody escapes. We don't always see what happens to them, but nobody escapes. But as the Haggadah says earlier, in every generation they come to destroy us, and God always saves from their hands, and we're still here, and they're all gone. And nation after nation, ideology after ideology that came to destroy us or oppress us, those are long gone or fading, and we're still here and thriving. And that's what happens at the end. So God puts a sort of a cap on the event, the finality, drowns all the Egyptians, and we move on. Yeah?
Are there some schools of thought then that what's happening around the world currently, ISIS, Israeli elections, whatever, is there a school of thought that this is God's plan? Because if God plans will be done for our sake, I'm just asking for...
I mean, the answer is certainly yes. We don't know what the plans are. But, I mean, when you see any major world event, the Torah would teach us this is God planning something, right? It's something which is so significant, which has such an impact on such a large part of the world. You know that God is somehow orchestrating some event, something, for a purpose. We don't know the answers why that is, what the purpose is.
But it's for our sake.
I mean, and this one's actually easier to see, because anything happening in the Middle East is going to impact us one way or the other. You know, that's clear. And whether it be fighting back against ISIS or ISIS spreading, that's going to affect the Jews in some, you know, very, very clear way. I mean, that's something you don't need to look too deeply to see. But yeah, I mean, any major world event is something which is there. Somehow God is guiding some event, orchestrating something to happen so that he's for the sake of the Jews, whether it be to reward us, to punish us, to bring us somewhere, to have something happen. But you could trace history. I mean, you can't see it as it happens, but you can see it after the fact. How did that affect the Jews? Where did that bring them? The Hadayinu continues. It says that had God drowned our oppressors but not supplied our necessities in the wilderness for 40 years, Dayinu. So God took us over the sea. He drowned the Egyptians, and we are put down in the desert. So we said, if God didn't supply our needs in the desert, it would have been sufficient. This one also, you could say, well, if we didn't have our needs in the desert, we would have died. But I guess we could have found somewhere to go. We could have gone to a nearby land. We could have gone back to Egypt, technically. If the Egyptians were all killed in the sea, they weren't going to mess with us anymore.
So,
the army was killed in the sea. Yeah, but the rest of them were already brought down by the 10 plagues. I mean, I don't know. But the God provided us in the desert for 40 years. So the idea here is that, so another commentary describes, well, God provides our needs all the time. I mean, we believe that all of our needs throughout history are provided by God. And if we're dealing with going to work and making a living, running a farm, we believe that anytime that we do have our needs taken care of, God is there providing for us. So why is this different in the desert than any other time in history? And the answer is, in the desert we were trained that it all comes from God. Because if we actually are going to work and making a living, we think that really it's coming from us. If we run a farm, and we plow, and we plant, and we harvest, we think that we're actually the ones who are creating the produce. When you're in the desert, and there's nothing else around you to eat, and you cannot cultivate the land, and there's no jobs to get, you know, there's no office buildings, and there's nothing to do, so then you know that it's all coming from God. And the time in the desert was supposed to serve for us as basic training as Jews. We spent 40 years in the desert. At that point, we're supposed to train ourselves to see how God provides for the world. So being in the desert was our basic training. It was, I heard someone describe it as, it was like being in a seminar. And we were being trained at the seminar of how to be Jews. And then we're put into the land of Israel, okay, now go act as Jews. But during that time, God provided our needs, showing us that you can only depend upon me, and that's where all sustenance comes from. Even when you go off to work, and you get a job, and you make money, and you run a farm, and you produce crops, ultimately it's all coming from me as well. And then it continues, well, had he supplied our needs, but not fed us with the manna, the man, in the desert, that would have been sufficient. So we actually distinguish from our needs in the desert versus the man. Because God could have given us other forms of food. I mean, God could have provided sandwiches. We could have had more animals to slaughter. God could have had the desert also grow crops. You know, God could have said, okay, that land in the desert, don't worry. Go cultivate it and you'll have a potato harvest. You know, he could have said that. But he gave us man. Man is considered, the rabbis describe it, as food which was not a physical food, but a spiritual food. It's an angelic food. The rabbis tell us the Jews, it was pure nutrition. We didn't have to use the bathroom. There was no waste when it came to man. We didn't have to use the bathroom in the desert. Man was a miraculous food. It was the perfect food. It purified us both in our body and soul, because it was perfect nutritionally and it was perfect spiritually, in all ends. The man prepared us to receive the Torah. The rabbis say that the Torah was only given to those who ate the man, meaning that there's actually a correlation between eating man and receiving the Torah at Mount Sinai. The word man in Hebrew is mem and nun. So mem is the value of 40, and nun is the gematria, the value of 50. The Jews received the Torah 50 days after leaving Egypt. That's when they stood at Mount Sinai. And then Moshe went on the mountain for 40 more days to receive the oral tradition. So the written Torah was the nun, the 50, and the oral Torah, the oral tradition, was 40 days. And that makes the man. The man is a combination of those two, 90. That all alludes to the Torah. The idea of man is that man came down every single day. It trained us in trust in God that, you know, you couldn't save your man for an extra day. If you saved it over, it would spoil. So you had to depend on God every single morning to provide your food for that day. It was a training in trusting God. Because every morning you woke up and your pantry was empty. And you had no food to eat for breakfast until the man came down. And every single night the man would spoil, so you couldn't keep it for the next day. So it trained us to trust in God, which was supposed to be a training again for receiving the Torah. And beyond that, it alludes to Torah, and that Torah is something which is also supposed to feel to us like new and exciting every single day. God gave us Torah at Mount Sinai over 3,000 years ago. The rabbis teach us that Torah is something which you should view as something which is fresh and new. Every time you pick up the Torah to study the Torah, you should feel like you're reading something new and exciting you never saw before. And the man was something which came down daily, something which is fresh, exciting every single day. And it represents to us the Torah, and it prepared us both in body and soul to receive the Torah. So there was a significance to man beyond just the needs in the desert. It then says that God gave us the manna, the man, and didn't give us Shabbos, it would have been enough. Shabbos is something which is set apart from the rest of the... It says later on in Dayenu that God gave us the Torah. But Shabbos is looked at as distinct, unique from the rest of the Torah. Why is that? Because Shabbos is such a special experience in that we have the ability to live a whole day in God's presence. And Shabbos is called a miniature of the world to come. Shabbos is an experience we can have, that we can actually experience spirituality, the spiritual rewards of the world to come in our lifetime. So it is something which is thought, you know, non-Jews are allowed to perform most mitzvahs, but the non-Jews are not allowed to keep Shabbos. You know, if a non-Jew keeps Shabbos, we tell them that we have to do some sort of work on Shabbos. Even somebody converting, we have them do just, you know, one act of melacha, just one forbidden act on Shabbos, because non-Jews aren't allowed to keep Shabbos. It's unique for the Jews. And it's something which shows how special we are. That God gave us a special gift called Shabbos. We can have one day a week to remove ourselves from the world and just be involved in God's presence. And that's something which sets itself apart as a special reason to thank God and to feel special as Jews. It then says that had God gave us Shabbos and that brought us to Mount Sinai, would have been sufficient. So the famous question here is that, well, God brought us to Mount Sinai and didn't give us the Torah, but what could Mount Sinai have been? Because we're going to say next that if God brought us to Mount Sinai and didn't give us the Torah, Dayenu. Well, Mount Sinai in our minds is just the location of getting the Torah. But if we went to the mountain, there was no Torah. What did we gain from going to the mountain? But the answer is that standing in Mount Sinai was an experience on its own right. Even if God didn't give us the Torah, but what did God do at Mount Sinai? There was thunder and there was lightning. We heard God speak. We heard God speak to Moshe. It was a full experience. The experience of Mount Sinai was an experience that changed our lives forever. The rabbis teach us that not only were the Jews who left Egypt there, but every single Jewish soul to ever exist stood at Mount Sinai as well. And that experience was something which changed our lives eternally. So that experience, even without the Torah being given, would be sufficient to have to thank God and show how unique the Jewish people are. And then it says that had God given us the Torah would have been enough. Obviously, the Torah is what really makes us Jews, and that's how we connect with God. So certainly the Torah is something to give thanks to God for. It then says, if God had given us the Torah and not led us into the land of Israel, it would have been sufficient. So it discusses the land of Israel. Now the commentaries point out, it's very clear, that the land of Israel without the Torah is not significant to us. Israel is significant because of the Torah. Meaning that Israel is the land where we're supposed to perform the Torah, live the Torah. It's the land where all the mitzvahs apply. Many mitzvahs do not apply outside of Israel. It's the land which is designated as the land to serve God. So we couldn't have said in Dayenu, had God given us Israel and not the Torah, Dayenu, because it's not true. Israel is not significant on its own right. Israel is significant only in light of the Torah. The Torah Tamima, one of the great commentators on the Torah, he writes that without the Torah, Israel has no benefit over any other land, no advantage over any other land. Just like without the Torah, the Jews have no advantage over any other nation. The Torah is what makes Israel significant. And because we have a Torah, we observe it in Israel, that's like doubles the power of the Torah and spirituality. But ultimately, without the Torah, Israel is not significant. So we say, if God gave us the Torah and didn't give us the land, that would have been sufficient. But God gave us the land. And the land of Israel, again, this is something that deserves a longer discussion. Its significance is that it is the primary place to connect with God. It happens to be beautiful lands, happens to be in a great location, happens to have beautiful mountains and oceans and lakes and everything else. We also enjoy the shawarma and falafel. But ultimately, the purpose of Israel is to be the land to connect with God. And we thank God for giving us such a special land that creates such a bond between us and the Jewish people. And I think any of us who have been there have felt that special connection. When you're in Israel, you do feel that you're connected in a way you don't feel when you're sitting here in Maryland. And finally, Dayenu ends. Had God given us the land of Israel and not led us to build the temple, then Dayenu. It ends with building the temple. Because the idea of building the temple is that that is the climax of Jewish history. Building the temple is considered our crowning achievement. That was the times of King Solomon. And that was the place, that was a physical address where you could go and experience God. It's something that we don't relate to on such a level. I mean, we do have shuls. We have places to go where we do feel more connected with God more than other places. But to be in the temple where God's presence was there and palpable to some degree, it's an experience which is unique for the Jews. Non-Jews are not allowed past a certain point. There was a sign, no non-Jews passed here. And we had a unique place to go and experience God's presence in this world. Also, the temple, all these blessings that God gives us are not worth much to us if we sin. If we sin, God takes them all away. The temple is a place for atonement and forgiveness. So the crowning jewel upon all of these different gifts is that God gave us a place to go, and if we do something which is wrong, and we fail, and we're in a situation where God wants to, God forbid, remove all these blessings, He gave us a location to go to, a ritual to perform, to achieve forgiveness. And that's part of the idea of the temple. So the Dayenu takes us all the way from being lowly slaves in Egypt to being the Jews standing on the top of the world experiencing God in His temple. And each step of the way should create an obligation for us to feel a true sense of gratitude towards God. And again, I would say Dayenu is supposed to be the headline of the entire Seder. The entire Seder is supposed to be an experience where we bring ourselves to gratitude on every single step of the way where God did kindness to us. So let's use Dayenu as that model to achieve true gratitude towards God at our Seders. Yeah. I mean, the events. The word Dayenu said 14 times, but the events listed are 15. If you count the events, it's 15 events here. Actually, I count 15 Dayenus too, but there are 15. I don't know what you're missing in your Haggadah. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. There are 15 events. The word Dayenu said 14 times, but there's 15 events there. That's the difference.